Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night, everyone. Welcome to our call 18 on the CCWG on enhancing eye cancer accountability on the 31st of March of 2015. This call is being recorded, as you are well aware, and I kindly remind you to state your name before speaking. This is not only for the transcript, but also for the recording as well, and to let those that are not on the Adobe Connect room identify those speaking. On the roll call, I would like to call for anyone who is not in the Adobe Connect room but is in the audio bridge to please state their name at this point so we can add you to the list of attendees. Is there anyone in the phone bridge that is not connected to the Adobe Connect room at this point? Okay. I see no one speaking on the phone bridge that is not in the Adobe Connect room, so we can continue. With regards to the statement of interest, this is just a reminder to please file in your statement of interest if you haven't done so after our 18th call. That must be some slippery memory on there. And if you have any problems filing your SOI and you need any assistance from staff, please feel free to contact them so they can assist you with updating your SOI. So I'd like to jump into the next point of our agenda. We have a pretty busy agenda for today. We're going to run through different aspects of our Istanbul meeting, some confirmation of conclusions, and the second read of some issues that were raised and that we received feedback from many participants in the group, many members, that they asked for a second read of different issues. I have a connection problem here at my Adobe Connect room, but I will continue to lead the agenda. And I would like to pass now to a little alteration of the agenda. I received a request to put the legal sub-team working methods and input received at an earlier stage before working party to fundamental bylaws and jurisdiction approach. So if everybody is okay with putting this forward, I would now go ahead and begin this point of discussion. I apologize if I don't see any hands at this point. I am having trouble with my Adobe Connect connection, so please feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions or comments. So with regards to this point on the working method,
Leon, it's Sebastian. We can't hear you. There is
We received two documents from one from Adrian Colvin, one from Sid Leon Austin. We have them on the call, and they will speak just after I address the points of the working methods of the legal sub-team. As you well know, the legal sub-team was envisioned or conceived in our Frankfurt meeting. As I said on our Istanbul meeting, we identified in Frankfurt the need for a legal sub-team that could lead the works with regards to legal advice that we will be needing, of course, to land our proposals and achieve our goals on this working group. So it was decided that a compact sub-team of the larger group would be formed, and there was an open call for joining these. We had an open call for joining this group, and everyone was of course welcome to come forward and join this legal sub-team. The group has continued to be open, but now since we have engaged with two different law firms. I proposed and I put on the table on our meeting in Istanbul a couple of considerations for approval, and well, we had agreement in our Istanbul meeting, and I just wanted to do a second reading of this point since some of our members and our participants raised some concerns with having a compact legal sub-sub team being the link or the liaison between two law firms and the larger working group. So you have in your screen the different rules of engagement and working methodologies that we decided to put in place so we could better coordinate our work between the CCWG, the legal sub-team, and, of course, the executive sub-team from the legal sub-team. And I put this on the list. I notified everyone on the list that we would be taking some steps forward, and there were going to be some changes to how the mailing list of the legal sub-team was going to be managed, and, of course, reminded of the working methods that we decided to take forward in our Istanbul meeting. And we received, as I said, some comments, and, of course, we're now opening this for a second read in order to confirm whether we have agreement on what was agreed in our face meeting in Istanbul. So the agreement that I call for at the moment is to ratify if the larger group, the larger cross-community working group, feels comfortable with having an executive sub-team from the legal sub-team who will act as liaison between the two law firms that have been engaged to provide advice to the CCWG and the larger working group. This is the reason for this proposal is because it is better and it's more manageable to have a compact set of people speaking to the lawyers directly rather than have a group of 160 people speaking to the lawyers at the same time. So this in no way means that those who are not part of the legal sub-team and those who are not part of the executive team wouldn't be able to raise any concerns or questions. On the contrary, this only means that this subset of people within the legal sub-team would have the obligation to collect any concerns or any questions from the larger group and turn them in place for the lawyers to be addressed and to be answered. So if I would like to call for agreement at this point on the second reading and confirm whether you have any objection on having this compact subset of people be the liaison between the larger cross-community working group and the two law firms that have been engaged to provide legal advice for our work. So I would like to call you to signal with a green tick if you would be okay on having this subset of people being the ones who address the questions to the lawyers and, of course, act as liaisons between the firms and the large group. Could you please now signal with a green tick if you agree to this?
Leon, we have Ebrard objecting on the list. I don't know if you're on the Adobe room, so probably Ebrard, you could expand on your objection.
Please do so, Ebrard. Could you please take the floor and explain your objection?
I have an good morning. Traffic was a bit unreasonable, so I'm a little bit late. I personally have a problem that we put it to a vote without even going to a debate. Separate issue. I do not agree with the proposed method. I would like that all correspondence between the lawyers and our subgroup is open and transparent. I agree with you that we do not need to have the full plenum be able to correspond with the lawyers, but I want to be able to read. An easy proposal from my side in this regards would be to say, okay, anybody who wants to subscribe as in a read-only mode to that legal sub-team list can do so. And if anybody has a topic or an objection, then it can be circulated on the main list, so that no other than the sub-team is actually able to directly correspond with the lawyers. But I want this to be an open and transparent process, and I want to read every, if I like, I want to read every correspondence between the sub-team and the lawyers.
Thank you very much, Eberhard. That is exactly how it is proposed. Maybe I wasn't clear on my explanation, but the email that was sent to the wider community mailing list expressly said that the modification made to the legal sub-team list would be that anyone that wanted to subscribe to the list and read the list would be able to do so, but only the subset of the of people who conform the executive team would be able to post to the list. But others, all other members from the community working group or even outside the community working group would be able and are able indeed to subscribe to the list. And as you said, the concerns would be raised through the general mailing list for the CCWG. So that's exactly how it was proposed and how it's functioning at this moment. So if you are okay with that, then we have an agreement.
I am in agreement with that proposal.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Eberhard. So could we have this set as a formal agreement from our group? Or is anyone does anyone have a further objection to this working method? Good. I see no objections on the Adobe Connect. I see many green ticks. Not all members are signaling their green tick. I don't know if they are simply not objecting. So I think we have an agreement here. And this this issue is now closed. And it's been decided to adopt the working methods proposed to the list. And, of course, the mailing list for the legal sub-team will remain open always to anyone that wants to read. And, as I said, the questions or concerns should be raised through the general CCW list for those who have no posting rights in the legal sub-team list. So with this, I'd like to now call... I see Jordan Carter's hand is up. Please, Jordan, could you please take the floor?
Just a quick practical question. If we're asking a question on the main list that we want the lawyers to look at or the legal team to look at, is there some common thing you'd like us to use in the header to indicate that? Like in the subject line, would it be helpful if we did it with legal question or something? Just to make it easier to understand or to see when questions are coming through. Is there some convention like that that would make it helpful, make it easier?
Thank you very much, Jordan. That's an excellent suggestion. I haven't thought of that, but now that you raise it, I think it would be an excellent help for us within the executive sub-team to have these legal questions or concerns identified in the subject as such, so we can, of course, grab them quickly and refer them to the lawyers. So, yes, thank you very much. I will, of course, emphasize this with a mail to the general list, so anyone that has any issues that must be brought in front of the lawyers could identify their mails with the subject legal question, as you suggested. So now I would like to call for our friends from Adler and Colvin and Sidley and Austin to take us through the documents that they kindly submitted for us with the initial responses or the initial replies to our legal scoping document. I would like to call for, I don't know if we have someone from Adler and Colvin present in the call?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, is this Rosemary?
Yes, it is.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. Could you please give us a quick walkthrough of the document that you submitted recently?
Sure, happy to do that. We were given 10 questions that we were asked to give our preliminary responses to, and I will just very quickly go through them. The entire document runs, 19 pages, so I'm not going to give you a lot of detail on any of them. And I will preface this by just saying that we're still very much learning about CCWG accountability, about ICANN, about all the other players. And so we definitely have some learning to go. These were very preliminary thoughts. The first question concerned available legal mechanisms like corporate structures, bylaws, articles, contracts, designator structures, membership, and so on. And the first question is by far the longest answer, I think, and we reviewed some of the structures that are available to ICANN as a California nonprofit public benefit corporation. There are various different models of governance that can be kind of, you can take a little bit from one and combine it with some from another, but there are three basic models, and I think it's likely that we will end up using either membership or designators, or possibly a combination of those two. And members are legal entities or individuals who are given the right to vote for directors. If they satisfy the statutory definition of member, then they get a whole bundle of rights. That's both a good thing and a bad thing. Those rights are very protected. It's all laid out in the statute, but maybe you want to be able to do something that you can't do because it would violate members' rights with some other set of people involved. So that's statutory members are one mechanism we could use to provide accountability. The normal structure is that the members would elect the directors, and as I said, again, members can be entities as well as individuals, and we could even, if necessary, create entities in the form of unincorporated associations to be the members if we needed to. If they don't exist as legal entities now, the entities that we decide should be the members. But members vote for directors. They don't have to vote for every director. They could vote for, this group of members could be grouped together and vote for these three directors, or that other group could vote for five directors. So there's a lot of flexibility that way, both between the way you structure the entities that are the members and then what director positions you allow them to vote for. We don't think you're going to use a self-perpetuating board. That doesn't seem to meet your needs at all. But the other form that we've covered here is designators. And it differs from directors in that typically designators appoint, they have certain seats. It's a legal entity that has the right to appoint seats, directors to fill seats on the board. But you don't get the whole constellation of membership rights. You don't get all the protections of membership rights that come with being statutory members. It's much more a matter of drafting a structure and California law clearly permitting you to have these people who name directors. And again, the designator could be an individual or could be more likely some kind of an entity. Neither members nor designators have any fiduciary duties to the corporation. Unlike directors who owe fiduciary duties to act in what they believe to be the corporation's best interest, and we'll get into that a little more in a later question, but I'm just pointing that out as in terms of these tools that we have available to work with to try and pull together a structure that will work for you. There are some principles of California nonprofit corporate law that are worth pointing out. One is that it's really designed to have the board of directors be the ultimate authority for governing the entity. And in a later question, we'll address some ways around that, but you're working a little bit against the grain of the corporate law when you do that. And that's because nobody else has fiduciary duties, and you don't really want people without fiduciary duties running the corporation because they have no risk associated with acting self-interestedly instead of for the common good. The normal way the board is kept accountable, again, this is just the basic legal framework, we can work around it, but we are indeed working around it a bit, is that if the members or the designators are unhappy with the way the board has performed, they can remove their particular director and in some cases even more broadly remove more of the board than the ones that they had the right to appoint. It is possible to have, it's not unusual in fact, to have a board, what we think of as the board, a relatively small, you know, somewhere between 5 and maybe 25 person body that we might think of as the real operating board, actually only be a committee of a very much potentially larger group. You might have a board of 50 or 100 or even in some cases 200 people or more. And obviously that board's not going to meet very often because it's so big and it's only going to deal with really extraordinary situations. And instead it is going to delegate its authority to run the corporation on a day-to-day basis to an executive committee or a smaller group within the board that is more empowered and will be much more engaged. And really importantly, the larger group, while it has fiduciary duties, would be entitled in discharging those duties to rely on that smaller group for the discharge unless they had some reason to believe that something was really going wrong in that smaller group. Like, you know, you heard a you got a reliable report that one of those people was never attending meetings or something like that. But ordinarily, absent some real cause to doubt the smaller group, the larger group's entitled to just rely on them doing their jobs. And that is a way of essentially discharging their fiduciary duties. I'm going to call that option maybe the super board option because it involves a really huge board and then a smaller, much more a huge and relatively not inactive board, less active engaged board with a much smaller, highly engaged board. You know, certain powers would always, certain authorities would have to be exercised by the full group, but not very many. They can really delegate quite a lot. They could also choose to hold back certain authorities like, you know, approving the annual budget, for example. So I think that we also summarized in that first question a possible structure where that uses both, I think it basically uses the designator approach, although we might be able to substitute membership in certain particulars, that's our answer to question one, is to kind of give you a sense of the tools we have to work with and how some of them, what their pros and cons are. The second question, does anyone have any questions about that?
Hi, this is
Deborah. I'm sorry, Leo Sanchez.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. We have very little time, so while I appreciate the detailed walkthrough that you're doing, if we could speed a little bit, and of course, we will have our legal sub-team call on Wednesday, and everyone that wants to join, since we are a very open group and a very transparent group, everyone will be able to join, and of course, have a deeper look at the document and expand any concerns or any comments that they might have. So if we could speed up a little bit the walkthrough, that would be very useful so we can keep our agenda on time. Thank you, Rosemary.
Sure. So the second question essentially has to do with responsibilities and liabilities. Directors have fiduciary duties. Statutory members and designators do not. The third question relates to some of the issues that are raised by having this very bottom-up process for decision-making as opposed to top-down. And what we've tried to do in that question is talk a little bit about some of the issues we see in defining the bottom group. It has to be very carefully defined because it's going to be much more empowered than it has been in the past. What decisions will it have? Who has what voting power on it, exactly who is in the group. Question four has to do with ways to prevent ICANN from experiencing mission drift and going off in directions that it wasn't intended to go. And there are certainly the articles and bylaws and the requirements for amending the articles and bylaws are one way to handle that. And it's also possible for third parties like designators to be able to consent if bylaws will be changed, although that's a little more complicated. The tax-exempt status is not going to be much help in terms of mission drift. The IRS doesn't really care about that. Charitable trust restrictions, I think have been, well, we'll get to that with the AG question. I think charitable trust is a good possibility, but it's going to take probably self-enforcement and litigation rather than relying on the Attorney General. We also addressed what was meant by using a trust form, which is a very non-evolving form of legal entity. The question five concerns fiduciary duties, and it just goes through what the fiduciary duties are and who has them. A key issue in that was, how do you have someone who represents a constituency but is supposed to act in the best interest of the overall corporation? How do you reconcile that? And we've addressed that there. Question six concerns the board being bound to accept decisions made by an independent entity or an independent review panel. This could be done with the super board structure. It could also be done through contract, with perhaps each director signing a contract agreeing to resign if they were unwilling or unable to implement the internal review panel's decision, or it could be done by a contract with the corporation itself entering into a third party so that there'd be a breach if it didn't follow the independent review panel's decision. Question seven concerns the Attorney General. While the Attorney General in California has very broad powers over California nonprofit public benefit corporations, the bottom line is that the California Attorney General is extremely unlikely, if it follows the usual pattern, to do so unless a significant diversion of charitable assets, a real misuse or theft or something like that, is involved. Now, it might be that ICANN is such an unusual and special corporation that the usual rules wouldn't apply, but ordinarily we would say the Attorney General doesn't really care about internal governance. They only care about misuse of assets. Question eight concerned how we could incorporate the affirmation of commitments into the bylaws, and we think that's certainly quite doable in a couple of different ways. Then there was a question nine about interim mechanisms for a caretaker board. Again, that's really not, California corporate law certainly isn't designed to accommodate that, but we think that there are a couple mechanisms we've suggested that might work. And you wouldn't need it if you did the super board arrangement. We also expressed some reservations about spilling the entire board. We think, as I said, that there are ways to do it, but we might not advise doing that, or maybe we would advise that you reconsider and we can talk it through. The last question, question 10, had to do with ways to limit director or damages of other parties in a lawsuit against ICANN. There's various volunteer protection laws that we don't think are particularly helpful. And I think the bottom line is that in the U.S., anyone who can afford the filing fee can sue anyone else for anything. That's kind of how our system works. So realistically, ICANN is operating in all 50 states. It's not going to be California law that's going to govern the rights of plaintiffs. It'll be wherever ICANN is operating and the person can establish jurisdiction of, you know, some other state's law. But we've suggested some steps you could take to manage the litigation risk as our answer to question 10.
Thank you very much, Rosemary, for this very quick review. I apologize for the time constraints, but we're very grateful on these comments. And, of course, we will be able to go deeper into the subject on Wednesday on our legal sub-team call, which I once again invite everyone that wants to join the call to do so. I will be asking staff to post the details for this call on the mail list, on the main mailing list, so anyone that wants to join can be able to do so. And now I would like to turn to Holly Gregory, who is here with us also from Sidley Austin, so she can walk us through in a very quick way also through the document that they kindly submitted to us with their initial answers. So Holly, if you are with us, can you please take the floor?
Yes. Well, good early morning, Leon and all members. Happy to be with you today. Look, I think that there's some overlap between the questions that were asked to Adler and to our group, and so I'm going to really whiz through this. I think the high-level point that you should take away on the legal mechanisms is that you have a lot of tools in the toolkit to accomplish what you'd like to. And it's a matter of looking at all of these tools that Rosemary just very helpfully described and thinking about how do you use them together to best fit your needs. So that being said, we think that through express provisions in ICANN's articles and bylaws, there are mechanisms that you can design to provide the multi-stakeholder community with the ability to do the things that you were talking about in Istanbul, for example, to influence the board composition, whether it's through removal of individual directors or recall of the entire board. You can limit the ability of the board to make unilateral changes to all or certain of your bylaws. For example, you can have mechanisms to ensure that certain bylaw changes can only be done with the agreement of the multi-stakeholder community, whether that's organized as a membership body or through some other means like some kind of golden bylaw kind of consideration. You can certainly provide the multi-stakeholder body, either through a membership or a designated representative, with approval rights with respect to certain kinds of board decisions. And we also think, you know, for example, you could have approval rights around budget and key policies or strategies. And you can certainly also, you know, provide that for certain types of decisions, if the board doesn't accept the recommendation of a specified committee or group, that the board has to become subject to member review and approval or some other mechanism. So that's all a long way of saying you have a lot of tools at your disposal. And I'm sure over the coming weeks, we'll have an opportunity to talk about how these tools can best be used to meet your objectives. I think in terms of preventing sort of an expansion of, mission creep, you've got articles and bylaws that you can use to ensure that the purpose for which ICANN is created is met. I'm not going to spend time on the answer to that question. You did ask us two questions that were unique to us. One was about other jurisdictional options. And so we think it's premature to sort of go through a jurisdictional review of every place in the world where you could possibly reincorporate an ICANN. That would be a very expensive endeavor, and I don't think that that's how you'd – I don't think it's advantageous for you to spend that money at this point in time. But we did want to mention that in addition and in the United States, by the way, we think that any of the 50 states would work. I think California is a great place to focus because ICANN's already there. And we can't think of any other state that would automatically be more advantageous. We do want to note that Switzerland also has a structure for non-governmental organizations, which contains some similar features to membership corporations organized under various state laws in the U.S. So we can also certainly look external to the U.S. if that makes sense. But we thought at this point, as we've outlined in the memo, it was enough to give you some of the views of those optionalities without yet digging deep into things. The other set of questions you asked us were about antitrust considerations. And just as a final note, we see no significant antitrust concerns here. It is an issue, of course, that you have to, you know, be mindful of. But there's no reason to think that the purposes for which you're talking about, account from an accountability perspective, raise any specific sort of cartel considerations. So with that, and in the interest of time, I will leave it, and I'm happy to answer questions. I believe we also have Michael Clark on this call. You met some of him in Istanbul, and also my colleague Josh Hofheimer as well, and they're available to help answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Holly, for this quick but very precise walk through the document. I would love to open the floor for questions, but that would take all the time that we have for the call. So once again, I invite you to the legal self-team call, which will be on Wednesday, and you'll have the details for the call on your inbox shortly. And I would now like to turn to Matthew for the next point of our agenda. And please feel free, of course, to raise any questions through the general list as proposed. And if you are not able to raise your questions through the list, feel free, as I said again, to join us in our legal self-team call. So, Matthew, could you please take the floor?
Thank you, Leon, and many thanks to Rosemary and Holly for their updates, which are very useful in the core of our meeting today, which was not intended to focus on this advice, but, I mean, looking at them is extremely useful. The core of our meeting today is really about confirming some of the conclusions we had in Istanbul and highlighting the path forward. And that's the reason why we thought it was extremely useful to have a quick overview of this legal advice. And now I will turn to the next item on the agenda, which is focused on the conclusions from Istanbul. And before that, I'd like to, I think it hasn't been mentioned, apologies from Thomas Rickert. So Leon and I are in the very uncomfortable position that we are missing one of our fellow co-chair who, for personal reasons, had to apologize for this call. So please forgive us if we are not as efficient as usual without Thomas, but we'll try to steer the group forward even without him. So in terms of conclusions from Istanbul, so we have a few items that are sort of we need to second read, and as well as items to look forward. So the first things that I'd like to go back to is probably the I think in the agenda we had put the principle of the fundamental bylaws. That's the way we called them in the co-chair statement. And there have been discussions regarding the right way to frame them. So the idea behind this was that, and the conclusion we had in Istanbul was that there would be provisions in the bylaws where any change would require affirmative approval with specific procedure requirements from the community. And the scope of these special bylaws, and we need to talk about how we call them, it would be the mission of ICANN, the core mission, the provision that is actually creating those special bylaws, the independent review panel, as well as the powers to change the bylaws and spill the board. And that was the scope we had agreed on in Istanbul. So in order for Becky and Work Party 2 to have clarity about where they're going, I'd like to make sure we are there is no objection to that conclusion, which comes after Second Thoughts, after Istanbul. I see none in the room right now. So I suggest we move to the next item, which is the jurisdiction approach. And first of all, on this item, I'd like to indicate that considering the high sensitivity of this topic, we as co-chairs did not feel a first reading in Istanbul was sufficient to mention it in the chair's statement, and I understand there was some remarks on the mailing list on that. And I don't, since we, I don't think it was mentioned at the end of the session that we were mandated to address this, we didn't feel comfortable enough, but it's certainly something we need to confirm or not. And to recap where we were in Istanbul on that topic, the notes say that we concluded that we, the CWG, were not tasked to change jurisdiction of ICANN, but to enhance its accountability. So the question that is relevant to our group is whether ICANN's accountability can be enhanced depending on the law applicable to its actions. Of course, the legal input we have now is useful for that. And as a consequence, we were concluding that we would not be putting specific recommendations regarding jurisdiction in Workstream 1, that we would consider in our scope something, a topic when a requirement we set could not be made or achieved within the California jurisdiction, and that we would rephrase the question I mentioned earlier about the enhancement of ICANN's accountability depending on the laws applicable to its actions as a problem statement we would use within Workstream 2. And that is the conclusion that I'd like to make sure we are still in agreement on. And I see a lot of things on the chat, but I think that's out of this. Keith, do you wanted to add something on the jurisdiction?
Yes, thank you, Mathieu. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Yes, thank you. So just circling back to the discussion that we had in Istanbul, I fully support the, I think the direction that a change of jurisdiction is not appropriate for Workstream 1. And if that's how we're going to characterize it, then I think, yes, a change of jurisdiction should not be part of Workstream 1. But as I noted in our discussion on the Tuesday afternoon in Istanbul, I think a certain expectation has been set by Fadi and his congressional testimony about importing the affirmation of commitment obligation number 8 for ICANN remaining in the United States jurisdiction is something that we can't ignore, and that I think we may need to leave a little bit of flexibility to consider over the coming weeks or month of work. I'm just concerned that if an expectation has been raised or set through Fadi's testimony before Congress on February 25th, that if the bylaws are to be amended to incorporate the AOC obligations, including obligation number 8 for related to jurisdiction, that needs to happen through the CCWG's work, in my opinion. I'm concerned that if the CCWG doesn't tackle this, then how will that happen? And is there a political risk of having that decision made outside the CCWG's work? In other words, from the bottom-up consensus community development work. I don't think we want that decision to be made unilaterally after the fact, if it needs to happen. So I'm fully supportive of the change of jurisdiction not being in Workstream 1, but if the bylaws are to be amended to deliver on the expectation that has been set by ICANN's CEO before Congress, then I think we need to make sure that we're prepared to tackle that work. So let me stop there and see if anyone else wants to jump in. Thanks.
Thanks, Keith. I think it's good that you raised this point again that we discussed in Istanbul. My recollection was that there was mention of the fact that, of course, it's I think it's in the articles of incorporation of ICANN, and it's very obvious in ICANN's bylaws and articles of incorporation that it's incorporated in California. And therefore, there was a legal question whether anything that would incorporate from the AOC would be totally redundant with the already existing mechanisms. And so probably, and I would turn to Leon, whether we could probably have a look at if the question which is raised is whether ICANN, it is somewhere in the bylaws of ICANN that it's incorporated in California. My understanding is that it's already the case, and that any additional provision would not add any certainty to this in any way. But probably that can be something to be worked at with the legal group. I see Becky's hand is up.
Hi, good morning. I guess the notion is, the question is there something that we've identified that we want to do that cannot be undertaken in accordance with California law? I came in late, so I didn't hear the entire legal briefing, but I'm not sure I heard that there's anything that we is important to us from the accountability perspective that can't be accomplished in accordance with California law. I mean, I guess that's the question, but I mean, we could spend the rest of our lives talking about, you know, what country, and I mean, it really is, we're really talking about a choice of incorporation as opposed to jurisdiction, as I've said a couple of times, because the jurisdiction in terms of, you know, whether ICANN can be hauled into court somewhere is much broader than California as a matter of sort of ordinary fact. But again, I'm not sure why we're getting sort of wrapped up in this unless there is something that we think is important to accomplish with respect to the accountability that can't be done in California.
Thanks, Becky. James?
Hi, this is James. Can you hear me? Okay, great. Thanks. So just want to agree with Becky and with Keith, the points they made. And I just have two observations. One is that this is a very lengthy and complex issue, given our very limited amount of time. I think we got, you know, whether or not it belongs in Workstream 1. And And then, as I and others have noted on the list, this is potentially and unnecessarily bringing political attention of a very negative type onto this work and then the transition as a whole. And so my question really, Leon, is if we can flip this around and say, are there any folks either, you know, within the membership of this group or their representative organizations and structures or maybe any of our outside legal folks, is there anyone driving this issue that says that this essentially must be a Workstream 1 issue? I'm wondering, you know, or have we kind of beaten this to death? Can we start to let it go now? Or is there something that I'm not hearing in the public discussion that keeps bringing up the issue of jurisdiction? Or is there someone that believes we just can't go forward until we get this matter resolved? Thanks.
Thanks, James. I think there was some broad agreement on the approach we were suggesting in Istanbul. And it's clear that there were questions raised about whether California jurisdiction would not constrain some of the items, our flexibility for accountability mechanisms. I see in the chat Arun was also raising a question. Raising a question related to this, which is about the relationship within a community, the relevant community and the jurisdiction. But so far in the requirement call we've had, I don't see any reason to believe that there is something that cannot be achieved in California. But it's certainly a question that is being raised very often outside of the U.S. in terms of whether ICANN can be accountable to the global community while remaining in California, and it's our task to be addressing it, which I think the proposal that we are having is sufficiently clear. Becky, is that...
Sorry, can I ask very quickly, Leon, if I can follow up just briefly, can we get some specifics on where this question is being asked, where those questions are originating, please?
Yes, this question... I'm sorry, Matthew.
Go ahead, Leon.
Yes, the question was directed to me. This question is assigned to the lawyers that we engaged with, so we can receive proper advice with regards to the jurisdiction issue. While we are posing different questions to the lawyers, we need to be specific on what we are asking. So, so far, with regards to jurisdiction, we have, of course, included a couple of questions in the scoping document that if you have gone through the initial replies that the law firms provided us, well, of course, they would be addressing this issue. And we are also adding some new questions. For example, the one that was raised by Jorge Cancio on whether there are any provisions included, usually, if any, on jurisdiction issues in the bylaws and articles of incorporation, and which is the current situation in the case of ICANN. So this is a question that we are assigning directly to the lawyers, and we would expect to have a reply in a short time. I don't know if that answers your question, James.
Yeah, and to add to this, Leon, I think James was asking for transparency about where these questions were coming from. Within our group, I've noted inputs from, for instance, Pedro from Brazil. I've noted input from Arun, and I see he's on the line, so that's good. And outside of our group, I can testify that this is, to me, as you know, I work in France in a multi-stakeholder organization, and I can tell you that whether from the business constituency or the civil society in France, this is the number one question I get about ICANN. And so that's, as transparent as I can be. Avery, you're next.
Thank you. This is Alfred speaking. On this jurisdictional issue, I think we're conflating two issues and making somewhat harder than it needs to be, though I preface this by saying perhaps I really don't understand. I, too, have talked to some of the people from other countries, Brazil being one of them, who have had this jurisdictional question. But I don't think that the jurisdictional question is necessarily centered around where ICANN, the corporation, is based. I think part of the issue, I think sometimes that's the quickest solution space we jump to. Aha, if it's in another country, then things will be easier, which I don't think is necessarily the case. I think that the issue is that for some of the interactions, for some of the legal questions, for some of the questions governments may have where they couldn't possibly come to a U.S. court necessarily, and at this point I start to get beyond my level of knowing what another government can do in a U.S. court, is that they're looking for some method of dealing with legal issues that don't necessarily, aren't necessarily restricted to U.S. courts and are somehow have available a more international arbitration, decision-making type process involved in them that is adequate at a government level. So I think that there's a real issue there, and there's a real issue that the world is looking at is how do we necessarily deal with ICANN. But I don't think that they're all saying, and therefore you have to move to Costa Rica, or therefore you have to move to Geneva. What they're saying is they don't see an appropriate mechanism for them as governments, as international bodies, as whatever, for necessarily bringing an action, a question, an issue before an appropriate court of judgment for their needs. So as I said, I think we're conflating the two issues. I think the notion of moving ICANN to another one is most definitely not a work stream one issue, and it's certainly nothing we could get done in the limited amount of time we have before us. I think addressing the question of is there a appropriate mechanism for others to get appropriate jurisdictional response, jurisdictional processes, is perhaps a question that we do need to tackle. Thanks.
Thanks, Avery. Before turning to Arun and Pedro, and I'll close the line after that, just a quick comment that I think we've agreed on an approach based on the requirements. Is there any requirements of accountability that would be linked to jurisdiction? And I would refrain our trend to try and be second-guessing political implications, because I think that might not enable us to get to a consensus at any point in time. We need to be aware of this somehow, but I think the strengths we have is when we get focused on facts and requirements, and that's where we can avoid getting into political debates that we cannot close anyway, because it's outside of our reach. So I have Arun next, please. Arun, are you muted? We cannot hear you. Arun, while you're trying to fix the sound, maybe we can move to Pedro.
Okay, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Perfect. Thanks, Pedro.
Okay, well, thank you. First of all, I'd like to highlight what was commented in the chat. Well, I think we definitely have agreed not to raise this issue of alternatives of jurisdiction mostly one, but I think it remains to be discussed whether this incorporation of Article 8 of the paragraph 8 of the article of incorporation into the bylaws, I think it's something we should discuss at this point. That was the one. So as to our opinion, I think we should rather, instead of imposing a certain jurisdiction, imposing jurisdiction under U.S. law, I think we should come up with, if we agree that this kind of issue should be coming into the bylaws, we should rather work with requirements like a stable regime and this kind of requirements into the bylaws rather than imposing a specific jurisdiction legal presence. And I agree with most of what Avri indicated. I think it's there are some concerns of governments and Inkai government that that are related with sovereignty in this kind of concept, with respect to being at some point in the process of accountability, having to deal with national courts and national specific issues that I think are not, let's say, appropriate for when states and governments are dealing with those issues. So I think this is something that maybe the person that raised this question wanted to know a little bit about the political reasoning behind. I think that's part of points out what the direction we want to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pedro. Do we have Arun online now?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, Arun.
Can you hear me, Matthew?
Yes, perfect.
Great, thank you. So on the issue of jurisdiction, I just want to agree with Avri on the, I guess, the more immediate concern with regard to jurisdiction from a legal perspective is who are the people who can approach the U.S. courts, given the fact that it is incorporated within California, primarily to U.S. courts. But I'm just looking at the Sidley Austin response that has come in on the specific issue of jurisdiction, and I noticed that the CCWG has, we have raised a very specific question, which I think has not been answered, which is which legal jurisdictions provide for the ideal balance between community control, technical stability, and responsible corporate governance within the CCWG's stated goals and concerns. Unfortunately, this question has not been answered in the notes that we have received from Sidley Austin. What we have got instead is what is possible, say, under Swiss jurisdiction, which is totally fine. I don't think there's any debate as to what is possible and what is not possible within a different jurisdiction. But to get to the question as to whether, you know, how jurisdiction may render some communities, I can accountable to some communities and not accountable to others, we would need a response from Sidley Austin on that count. I understand you don't want to get into the political implications of this, which is true, but, you know, for instance, there was a point raised about Fadi's testimony to the Congress, and I'm wondering how Fadi's testimony to the U.S. Congress is relevant. It's relevant only because ICANN is incorporated under U.S. law, although the U.S. Congress has no legal say, strictly speaking, because the oversight authority rests with the NTIA, which is an executive arm of the government. So there are some political implications which I'm sure the CCW is not too comfortable with discussing, but we can only move forward if the Sidley Austin response to this question that we have raised is answered properly. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Arun. What I'm taking from this discussion is that the discussion regarding whether or not to incorporate Article 8 from the AOC still generates some questions, and I would
put an action item to, I think what the question we have to raise with our legal advisors through this legal sub-team would be probably to have a look at what extra accountability would be brought to the community if it was incorporated, considering that ICANN currently has some provisions, is basically already incorporated. And that's something we should probably look at in terms of extra accountability. And there's the questions regarding the balance in jurisdiction that's been quickly touched upon by the initial legal advice that needs certainly further investigation. But taking that into account, I am not hearing any objection so far to the fact that our scope remains focused on any aspect of accountability that could not be achieved, enhancing ICANN's accountability. I'm trying to make it clear. So let me recap. What I'm understanding we're still in agreement on is that our goal is to enhance ICANN's accountability, and therefore the topic of jurisdictions comes into our scope when a requirement we have for accountability cannot be achieved within California. And so that's really the key aspect as far I think, which is going to be helping us move forward. And as we keep investigating, the problem statement, which was whether there was enhancements possible depending on the laws applicable to the actions of ICANN through the various layers of the question of jurisdiction, then we would take this on for Workstream 2. And with the provision that we need to look at Article 8 of the AOC, I think we could move forward with this topic and focus on the other aspects of the task we have at hand for Workstream 1. And with that, I just would like to ask whether there's any objection on this way to move forward. First of all, whether it's clear enough for you to comment on that, or if there's any objection to this way forward on this discussion. Arun, I assume it's an old hand.
Yeah, that's an old hand, sorry.
Thanks, Pedro, for your confirmation. So we'll make sure the notes are clear so that we can refer to them later, but it's as a second reading. I think it's important that we are clear on that, and there are action items for transfer to the legal sub-team. Okay. Moving on. I think we're now going to move into the work parties updates and taking stock from Istanbul. And so there will one action item is a specific review of the notes on the jurisdiction topic by the co-chairs, so that we make sure they're fully consistent with what we've been discussing. I think I can't do that live on the fly while sharing the meeting, but we'll do right after that. So turning to Work Party 1, I will turn to Jordan shortly, but before that, just a recap of what we understood we were in agreement on in Istanbul, so that we also take stock. There was two main items for Work Party 1. Number one is the community mechanism, where we had extensive discussions around various options. My understanding, and Jordan, please step in if necessary, was that there was some form of agreement that voting would be involved somewhere and it needed to be transparent, that except for board removal, board recall, the votes would not be directed by the SOACs. and of course that the SOSs would be the basis for who has a vote. And for most, and for all discussions, for all powers, there was also a common ground, which was that there was no specific standing of review for the decisions to be made, no specific cause required. And I think those were the common points on the community powers. And Jordan, maybe you could take over here, both to check whether that's consistent with what you heard, and to explain how you're planning to move forward.
It's Jordan here for the record. Thank you, Matthew. I think that was a nice summary, and I do think that you've identified the areas of consensus that came in Istanbul last week.
Jordan, do you want to explain how you're planning to proceed now to move to the next stages of further refining the community mechanisms?
I can only explain that I'm horribly jet-lagged and just got back into the country about 24 hours ago, and that we've got a Working Party One meeting scheduled for Wednesday 2100 UTC, so that's Thursday morning, and that I haven't yet turned my mind to the process that we're going to follow. But I think what we'll do is some quick drafting work to just try and tighten up on the options that we looked at in Istanbul in regard to the kind of community mechanisms, and see if we can come to a consensus in Working Party One about which approach to investigate further with the lawyers and to debate with the CCWG, and then hopefully to have that as an agenda item at the call next Tuesday. To be honest with you, that's about as far as I've gotten. So in terms of the mechanism, that, and for the rest of the work, also to be summarizing, writing it up, but I'm afraid I haven't got anything more to give you at this point.
Thanks, Jordan. It's perfectly understandable, and I know you've been very involved in the CWG meeting as well. Regarding the items, I tried to summarize a quick check whether there are objections, because obviously if not, then they will provide useful guidance to the Work Party One group as they move forward. I am currently seeing none, which is good. So good luck, Jordan, for the next steps. I think within Work Party One's scope was also the AOC reviews, where there has been some turnaround already by Steve, and probably others were working on it as well, but many thanks. Steve has incorporated in the latest versions the features that we discussed in Istanbul. I had noted the increased transparency features, such as full access to documents and annual report on accountability and transparency. Incorporating the new reviews, the potential for incorporating new reviews in the review system is also part of the proposals that have been integrated by Steve. And we had noted in Istanbul, this is not an agreement point, but that there was still a discussion point on the balance, on the way to appoint the members of the review teams. There's a clear intention that the community selects their own representatives, and there was some comments regarding the need to balance this with the need to opt for a diverse team overall. And that's currently, I'd say, an open point. okay. So thanks, Steve. I'm confusing the mailing list. So it was circulating on Work Party One, and so it's perfectly normal if some of you have not seen the document I was mentioning. Steve, do you want to add anything to the summary I was trying to give on the agreement points from Istanbul so that we take stock of them as a second reading?
I leave it to Work Party 1 rapporteur to decide whether to circulate that out, but I think you had gave a good description of the significant edits that were made to the four reviews and bringing them into the bylaws. It's up to you, Jordan. Glad to circulate to everyone.
I'm pretty confident you already have, Steve. You sent it out on the full accountability list and copied it to ICANN staff about 14 hours ago at 5:31 my time. So that's whether that was 16:30 UTC yesterday. But my proposal actually is that we don't spend time discussing it here, because first of all, we did discuss it in Istanbul, and secondly, the working party hasn't yet had a chance to discuss and absorb the feedback. So unless someone's got a really urgent item to raise about it, I think we should pass over this and come back to it next week.
Thanks, Jordan. Just making sure there's no objection to the summary we did from Istanbul, so that you have these items clear when you move on with the document. And I'm seeing none. So a reminder, the main conclusions are increased transparency features and ability to incorporate new reviews when necessary. I see no objection. I think that's useful guidelines. And so we now go to Work Party 2. And I know there was a call yesterday focused on the mission and commitments and core values, which was an important part. We actually have three items for Work Party 2. The mission and core values, the independent review panel, where I would just go through the main conclusions of Istanbul to make sure we're still in agreement. And we'd like to open a discussion on reconsideration process, which we didn't have time to address in Istanbul. So maybe on the mission and core values, Becky, just to update the group on where the work is going and how it's planned to be sent to the whole group.
Sure. We had a very good call yesterday and went through a revised document that was revised to reflect input from Istanbul, both in terms of substance and in terms of format. We got, I think we had a very good discussion about it. I am waiting for further comments from the group, but we should be in a position to circulate a revised annotated draft that does a much better job of sort of comparing the existing bylaws with the proposed changes, and we should be prepared to circulate that later this week, I would think, to the entire group, hopefully incorporating all of the input that we got from Istanbul. I've also asked people to provide questions in response to it that could be part of the consultation. So that is moving forward quite nicely. On the independent review, we have not had a further call on that, so I will leave it to you to discuss the points you wanted to confirm, the points of agreement you wanted to confirm. And then Robin, who is taking the leading oar on the reconsideration, I think it's prepared to kick off that discussion tonight.
Thanks, Becky. So we have an action item, or actually an expected item, to have a look at the mission statement in the new version later this week. Regarding the IRP, the items I had taken from the notes of the meeting were that this would be part of Workstream 1. I think that was widely approved, that it was meant for ICANN to be accountable to all stakeholders with provisions against frivolous claims, and of course that there were a number of items to be looked at in terms of how binding it could be, that was subject to provision to legal advice. But I think that those were the main items, and there was strong support for the initial proposals that were pushed forward. Just making sure that this is still something that is shared with the group. And so that you can proceed on that, seeing no objection, I think we can move on. This is largely formal, but now we can get to a more substantive discussion point regarding the reconsideration process. And as I said, we did not have time in Istanbul to address this, and I'm very pleased that we can take now a few minutes to discuss the proposals drafted by Robin on the enhancements to the reconsideration process. Robin, can you give us a quick overview of the template you feel and circulated on the list?
Sure. This is Robin. Can you hear me okay?
Okay, thanks.
Great. Okay, so I'll just go over some of the comments, compiling the different comments that we've received so far on this issue, and putting them into the template. On the issue of standing, there was a thought to amend who has proper standing to file the reconsideration request, so to basically widen its scope and to include any party that's impacted by the ICANN's decision or inaction. With respect to standard of review, it's been suggested to amend the standard to include re-examination of the underlying merits of arguments and decisions and broaden the types of decisions which can be re-examined. Also amend when the Board Governance Committee may summarily dismiss a request. And also make it clear that a frivolous claim amounts to a cost that would be extraordinary in nature, and a few word changes, like deleting the word querulous and changing actual to notice under the standard of review. In terms of composition, it's been suggested that there'd be less reliance on the legal department to guide the Board Governance Committee on its recommendations and recommend more board member engagement in the decisions, including early on in the decisions, amending the rules so the Board Governance Committee doesn't have the option of making final decisions on some issues with fuller board briefing and discussion of the issues. Calling for more transparency in the decision-making process. With respect to the issue of precedential value of reconsideration request decisions, it's been suggested that people be able to challenge precedential value of previous decisions. However, the precedent doesn't reopen. If a precedent is overruled, it doesn't reopen old cases. Some issues of accessibility have been raised. One is extending the time deadline for filing a reconsideration request to 60 days from when the requester learns of the decision. Right now, the filing deadline is 15 days from when the decision or action is taken and posted, or when one can reasonably conclude an action or decision will not happen. So that should make the process more accessible. In terms of implementation, it's been suggested that requesters may need some kind of follow-up process regarding implementation of the decision that's been reconsideration. And finally, there were a number of due process concerns in the reconsideration request issue. Suggestions to provide all briefing materials that are supplied to the board to the requester so they may know the arguments against them and have the opportunity to respond, subject to legitimate and documented confidentiality requirements, of course. Some concerns that final decision should be issued sooner, and requests for urgent reconsideration should be broadened and less subjective in criteria for acceptance of urgency. Requests considered urgent should take into account legitimate business needs for relative certainty of rules in a timely fashion. So those were the different suggestions that have come in and for reforms needed to the reconsideration request process. So if there are others, any comments on any of these or additional points to be raised, now would be a good time.
Thank you very much, Robin. Any questions for Robin? Well, so far there's none, but I have one, and it's both for Robin and Becky. How do you foresee the interaction between the reconsideration process and the IRP? What I mean by that is, do we need to articulate how a failed reconsideration might lead to an IRP appeal or something? Is there something we need to be more explicit about on this?
Yeah, that's a good point, because it's my understanding that in order to get to an IRP, a reconsideration request would have to be filed and denied. So if I'm wrong about that, or if we need to more clearly spell that out somewhere, probably in both processes, we should do that.
Thanks, Robin. I see Becky's hand is raised. Becky?
Now, I think the answer to that question depends a little bit on what the substantive work of the independent review is, or what the scope of their work is. Right now, we have, you know, fairly narrow grounds on which reconsideration can be approached. And assuming that, you know, depending on how the sort of what the standard of evaluation is, that would affect whether this is, you know, something appropriate or required to sort of exhaust before you go to IRP or not. And right now, as a standard practice, people seem to bring a reconsideration request, you know, sort of as an exhaustion of remedies, so that nobody can complain you should have gone to a reconsideration request rather than going directly to an IRP. Depending on what the standard is, that we may need some more clarification on it. And so one of the questions that I had for Robin actually goes to that point in terms of, you know, if we're talking about the broadening the scope of reconsideration to sort of go beyond, you know, new information, new facts, et cetera, whether, you know, that would tie into the violation of the bylaws kind of standard that we're looking at it at the independent review, or whether there's some other standards that we're talking about for reconsideration.
Thanks, Becky.
This is...
Go ahead, Robin,
sorry,
if you have...
Robin. Just speaking from my own understanding, I would think that the the standards that we're talking about putting into the bylaws would be the standards against which reconsideration requests could be measured, because one of the points of the reconsideration request is to look at whether or not the bylaws are actually followed. And so I think that would fit I think that would fit right underneath that particular issue, because if you're saying that the bylaws include these certain core mission things that aren't in the mission, and then if things actions are being taken arguably in contention to that, I would think that the reconsideration request avenue would be available to try to rectify that situation. But that's just my understanding, and you know, I think this is really the first time that we've really looked into this issue in detail. So I think it's worth a good bit of discussion from the group.
Thanks, Robin. I think this highlights some avenues of work for to investigate this reconsideration. I also took note of Samantha's chat note regarding potential conflict or at least paradox between extending the timeline for filing and the timely issuance of decisions. We need to make sure we fine-tune this correctly, but I think we have a very, very promising set of recommendations regarding enhancements to the reconsideration process. And so certainly something that is very encouraging. So probably the action items would be for Work Party 2 to refine the proposals for reconsideration. I would like to check whether there's agreement within our group that this is a Work Stream 1 recommendation. Is any objection to that? I think that was in the initial scope as we were seeing it in Frankfurt, although not fully explicit. And it's an assumption that I think we need to make sure we are in agreement on. I see Steve's agreeing, and Becky as well. So we are working on that assumption, and we're putting that in the notes. That this is on our list for Workstream 1. And with that, I think we can close the Work Party 2 item with extended thanks to the team, because they're both on the mission reconsideration and independent review panel. These are three extremely important items for our Workstream 1 recommendations, and the progress so far is outstanding. So let's keep the good work going, but we're in good shape on that side, really, thanks to your dedication and extra work. So that's worth noting. I am now turning to the stress test working party, and I think we'll, considering the time and our remaining items, we'll keep it very short, just a short update on progress and planning for the stress test working party. And I turn to Cheryl for this update.
Thank you, Mathieu. Cheryl, for the record. And it had always been planned to be a very short update, regardless of where it was in the agenda timing. As you know, the primary focus of our work in Istanbul was on the other work parties, and that was necessarily a good thing for us, because, of course, until Work Party 1 and 2 get a lot more of their work done, we're really not in a position to go a great deal further as fast as we need to towards the end of our process pre-drafting, and particularly because we would like to make sure that we bring the whole of the community through, as in our community working group, through the exercise of the essential, and it is essential, stress testing that is done in that process. However, during the Istanbul meeting, there had been plans for an informal discussion of the work party, and I'm delighted to report that we had an excellent turn-up for our informal breakfast meeting to discuss what was Stress Test 21. Correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, but I think it's 21, which discussed some very important issues of the delegation, re-delegation, CCTLD world, and that's the type of conversation that is so much more productive when had face-to-face. I want to note for the record that I think the outcomes of that were more than satisfactory, and it's put us in a much firmer place. I also wanted to update you since our last update that we held our what are to be, with the exception of this week, weekly meetings, and we had done a final first read-through of all of the stress tests to date at that point. Since Istanbul, however, we have made a couple of minor edits, and I'm going to ask Steve to go through those, and it won't take very long at all, and remind you that as of next week, we will be back to what will then be weekly stress test meetings. I just want staff to confirm that they will be at the fixed time we've held the last couple at, and if they could confirm that either here in chat or later to the list, that would be appreciated. And remind you, of course, that you are all more than welcome to join us at those calls. We will continue beavering away with our work. And with that, just over to Steve to briefly catch you up on what's happening with the drafting changes, if any. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Cheryl. As you indicated, we made some edits to Stress Test 21 that Eberhard had recommended. That stress test is far from finished yet, but we are trying to accurately reflect the situation that goes on with the revocation and assignment of CCTLDs. We also added a stress test that Edward Morris had proposed. It's on page 15 of the document. It's not complete yet either. And most importantly, when I went through the entire draft, I found 8 stress tests where the stress test work party had noted that one of the proposed accountability mechanisms was a community veto, empowering a supermajority of the ICANN community to veto a board decision. That's distinct from an IRP or reconsideration. And I went through in the 8 stress tests where that lives. I simply applied a strike-through text to that statement since we've not really tabled that as a proposed measure yet, the community veto. It's possible that Work Party 2 will get around to that in the days that have come ahead, but I didn't want to jump the gun by presuming we had a community veto, especially when we gravitated so well towards the IRP mechanism in Istanbul and the accompanying reconsideration request that Robin just went through. If we end up with a community veto, then it would be in there, and I can remove the strike through. But I think it calls attention to the fact that it's a somewhat fluid package of mechanisms and powers, and we don't want the stress test to presume that something will be incorporated when it isn't. That's all I've got, Cheryl.
Great, thank you very much. And with that, just briefly before I hand back to you, Mathieu, just a little heads up. The CWG meeting did at a number of points in their deliberations also raise this needs to go into stress testing comments. And both Avery and I will work, Avery's acting, as I think I mentioned in last week's report, as a liaison for us between the CWG and the CCWG work on this and other matters, but now particularly this. And we'll work with the leads on RFP4 out of the CWG to ensure that in the next week or so, maybe two, we bring across to our work party the particulars of any additional stress tests or tweaks that might be required to capture their needs. And that's it from us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Cheryl. And it's worth noting that the stress tests are one of the key areas where we have interrelation with the CWG on both sides, because I've noted in the CWG co-chair statement that they were taking on board some of our stress tests to actually check against their own proposals under consideration, which is obviously very useful. If there are no further questions on the stress test working party,
I suggest we move to another of the key outcomes of Istanbul, which is the discussion on the timeline. In Istanbul, we realized that we were heading towards a slightly amended timeline with our target date for public, for finalizing our recommendations for public comment being 21st of April, and the need for provision for two public comment periods. In addition to after our meeting in Istanbul, but during the CWG meeting in Istanbul, we have received communication by the CCNSO Council that the endorsement of our proposals will need to take place during, will require a face-to-face, regularly planned CCNSO meeting so that all of their members could attend and discuss. And taking this into account, we have, we as co-chairs have asked staff, and Barry in particular, to recompile a realistic timeline incorporating these two requirements. So two public comments plus the CCNSO endorsement at a regular meeting. And this is what I think it's valuable to share with you now so that we have a common understanding of what a realistic timeline looks like and see whether there are any comments on that. So Barry, I see it's currently being put online. So would you take us through the high-level changes you've made by when instructed so by these requirements?
Thank you, Mathieu. This is Barry Cobb for the transcript. So there's a couple of major changes that have occurred to this timeline, and I've unseated within Adobe Connect so that everybody can scroll on their will. First and foremost, as many will have known, the overall format hasn't changed much. We have the CWG timeline up on the top, and then, of course, the CCWG timeline on the bottom. Just a couple of points to note about the CWG timeline. They did review this change in timeline in Istanbul, them being the latter part of the work week in Istanbul. They do have a tentative target to complete their draft proposal for public comment for the 20th of April. They do intend to have intensive work week post-public comment period, which is for 30 days, and still deliver to the SOs and ACs prior to Buenos Aires, and then, of course, delivering their proposal to the ICG on the 25th of June. In terms of the CCWG, there are some slight changes as well. So the first is a distinction in the fact that we are working on the Workstream 1 proposal now. There has been a slight adjustment into when we were going to go for public comment, which is, according to this timeline, is scheduled to occur on the 21st of April for 30 days. You'll notice that the Work Party 1, Work Party 2, Work Party 3 will still continue along, and that we still have the legal input. And Mathieu can correct me if I'm wrong, but the intent with this adjusted timeline is that a draft of some sort would still be submitted to the chartering organizations for their review during Buenos Aires and the sessions that will occur and all the dynamics that will occur during the meeting. But post Buenos Aires, The CCWG will continue drafting the Workstream 1 proposal, and as Matu had mentioned, conducting a secondary public comment for an additional 30 days with a delivery to the SO and AC or charting organizations, which looks to be about the 1st of October. There are essentially 21 days there for the charting organizations to approve. Again, this does entail incorporation of the ICANN 54 meeting. But what is of notice, and I think what is a change for what you've seen from previous versions, is how the proposals will be delivered. And so as we move along the timeline from previous versions, there was a distinction between the ICG and the ICANN board that were definitive timelines. It's not possible for us to understand or basically to speak for those groups that
Larry, you still here? Okay, so Barry's line has dropped. So, can you still hear me? Can someone still hear me?
I can.
All right. So, while Barry is trying to reconnect, there was the discussion stemming on the chat whether there was the public comments were before or after the ASO-AC endorsement. And so far on our timeline, it's always been public comments before ASO-AC endorsement. I'm currently checking in the charter whether there's clear requirements on that. But I would be surprised if we went the other way around, because the CWG is chartered just like we are. Can staff maybe point us to specific sections of the charter that clarifies this? I would tend to think it's probably more efficient to go for public comment first, and I would expect some pushback from the chartering organizations if we don't go to public comment first. Yeah, I don't see that in the... So, Steve, we'll check with the CCNSO, but I don't think that was the expectation from the CCNSO. I would be very surprised if it were. It's a CCNSO council discussion, so maybe, Becky, if you're still on the line, you can clarify this, but...
I would think that we have to have the consultation before the endorsement.
Okay, so I think we can safely say that the public comment or public comments are expected to happen before the chartering organization's approval. And that's I think the main argument for that is that because before we submit to the board, we need to have approval by all ASO and ACs, at least the chartering organizations, and as a consequence, any public comment that would take place after that could not amend
the outcome unless we go back to the SOACs. And so that I think that's really a strong argument in favor of the way we are proceeding right now. I don't know if Barry is back on the line. Yes, apparently.
Yes, Mathieu, Barry there. Sorry about that. So I don't recall where everybody heard me drop off, but I did want to touch on to the fact that between both groups there is a change of this timeline, and again, it's the white boxes that denote delivery of their respective proposals to the ICG and or the ICANN board, the CCWG, of course, to the ICANN board. At this point in time, it's difficult to say or to depict how long it will take them to review the proposals or what their actions are going to be afterwards. So we've removed that facet from this particular timeline. Now just focusing back on to the CCWG timeline, and again, forgive me for not knowing where I dropped off, but the idea here is that in June for the Buenos Aires meeting that a draft proposal will be submitted to the chartering organizations for their review. There will be extensive discussion about the draft proposal. Afterwards, the CCWG will engage back in the beginning of July, roughly, continue their drafting, a potential for a secondary public comment period, and I have omitted a TBD on what that date might look like, leading us all the way into the October time frame to deliver a final CCWG proposal on or about the 1st of October. That will give the charting organizations an additional 21 days to review, and upon review and possible acceptance by the charting organizations, that would be submitted to the board. The last thing that I'll close in on, and I'll turn it back to Mathieu, is the secondary half, which I believe everybody sees from October stretching out in 2016, is the implementation oversight component. This bar is not necessarily new from previous versions of the timeline. What is different is that it begins to start to break out the six or so yet to be fully determined tracks of what would need to be implemented should the proposals be approved. And this is where it gets into the delineation. You'll see kind of a long-dated description about how there's a depiction between or a note of what particular mechanisms should be implemented prior to transition versus what mechanisms would be committed to prior to transition. That's yet to be defined. But the key driver behind this higher-level implementation oversight timeline is that any bylaw changes do require public comment periods as well, and those are yet to be fleshed out depending on the final proposal that's delivered to the chartering organizations. But the general intent is that it would probably take us into the June timeframe of next year to implement across these. And one final note, on the very, very bottom of this overall timeline is Workstream 2. Again, this is kept in simple form because we don't know the exact scope or delivery mechanisms that are going to dictate what that timeline looks like, other than just to make a presence that it is here and it will be considered and delivered on. So I'll stop there. Thank you, Mathieu.
Thank you, Barry. I think it's useful to have this overall timeline spread out in front of us for to discuss, to make sure we have the same understanding. And so I have Sébastien on the line for a comment.
Yes, thank you. I would like very much to have from staff what is the current length of a public comment in our, I will not say bylaw, but what is a real public comment length? And second, it's at what time the document must be published before a meeting? And my last question is, what if one of the chartering organization want any change in the document delivers the 1st of October? How we will deal with that, and what will be the consequences on the agenda? Because it seems to me now that if all the chartering organizations didn't accept the document as it is, it will be difficult for the board to act at his meeting in Dublin. Thank you.
Thanks, Sébastien. I'll turn to Barry and staff for the first question, but regarding the second one, obviously the key for us is to get input from ASO and ACs at each public comment so that the endorsement phase is purely formal. We've already had extensive feedback from those ASO and ACs. Otherwise, as you're saying, the timeline will be blown out. Maybe on the initial question from Sébastien, who can answer that? Barry?
Thank you, Mathieu. Yes. So as Greg alluded to on the list, starting in 2015, there's a new rules for how public comment periods are hosted, which is a 40-day public comment period by default. That period can be shortened based on approval from two global leaders internally within ICANN, and hence you see the 30 days on this particular timeline. As it relates to implementation, there's a much further runway, and you will see that it's noted as 40 days here. But given the aggressive timeline that we're on, we're attempting to do the 30 days as it's noted here. Again, subject to change based on conditions, but that is how it's drawn out now. And noting that the 40 days is just a general public comment period, unlike the 21-21 that was the previous rules before, 21 being for a general public comment period and 21 days being for a reply to the original comment.
Thanks, Barry. Jordan, you had a different perspective on the timeline towards Buenos Aires, so I think it's important that you can share it.
Well, it might also, Jordan here, it might also be a matter of clarifying, which is that we're all going to be very busy, right? And I don't think that squishing another version of our document in between the closing of the public comment and the discussion with SOs and ACs in Buenos Aires is a good idea. What I was thinking that we would be more likely to do is have the public comments in April, May analyzed, summarized, and some intensive work on our part to kind of prepare for the discussion. It's not a formal submission process to the SOs and ACs in Buenos Aires, because we're not looking for them to approve it. But then after that meeting, we would we'd have the perspectives on the public comment back, and we'd be in a good position after that meeting to prepare our next draft. But I think if we try and squeeze in a draft update from the public comment period in between that closing, because it closes in, 21 May, and then we'd have to have an intensive work weekend, try and get another document out in time to lead 15 working days before the BA meeting. I just think that's insanity in terms of actual practicality for the work we have to do. And I think that it is all part of overloading the community if we keep saying, let's have another look. So my assumption, my proposal, whatever this is that we have the discussion based on the draft that's gone for public comment and the feedback that has come. I think we should definitely summarize those comments, and if we can, through an intensive work weekend, give our initial thinking about responding to it, and then have that dialogue in BA, and then have another cut. The related point there is that we would need, if depending on the nature of the feedback that we get, either we'll be able to prepare that second draft with relatively little effort. I don't know if little effort is the right word, but sensible effort in June, July, or we will need to have a face-to-face meeting to do a thorough re-engineering of what we did if we've gotten lots of negative feedback about it. So I think we should just try and flag either, I hate to say this, given how long the meetings are anyway, but we would need to see if we need to fit in some time at the end of the ICANN meeting or something in that July period. So that's just my initial thoughts in response to this, which is a very helpful and more sensible timeline. The last point I'd just make is that how can the CWG finalize its names proposal without us having finalized our accountability proposal? Has anyone talked about that with them? Thanks.
Thanks, Jordan. I think I'm pretty much in agreement with what can realistically be expected from the turnaround in June and the preparation for Buenos Aires that you're suggesting. It's probably more or less going to be summarizing the public comment input as well as some of the perspectives we have on how to address this in order to engage with the SOACs. And I think that's really much what we can achieve. Our plan actually was to, and that's an idea we wanted to share, was to try and set aside a meeting right before Buenos Aires, a face-to-face meeting on the Friday before Buenos Aires, so that we can actually finalize some of the analysis of the public comments, and then probably find some time in July to finalize our recommendations, either face-to-face or through an intensive work session. So I'm conscious of time because we've reached the end of our call already, and I don't want to take too much of your time today. But I think it's useful feedback. It does not really change the overall timeline, but it's clarifying the expectation we can have from June. We need to be aware of the fact that this is a significant. There's a significant difference in terms of the expectations that have been placed upon our group by some of the SOACs, the board, and the relationship with the CWG. So what I would ask, add as an action item is I think we as co-chairs need to communicate very clearly about this new expected timeline to the endorsing organizations, to the CWG, probably to the ICG as well, and to the board, so that there's clarity about where we're heading and what we're planning. And I think that would certainly, maybe it will lead to some pushback and some adjustments that we need to make, but at least it's, I think, good policy for us to be transparent about what our timeline looks like now, considering the constraints that are being put on us, and try and engage on this discussion with the relevant other stakeholders. So unless there are objections, we would add an action item for the co-chairs to draft a communication to these other organizations on this. This will certainly be a point we touch on when we coordinate with the CWG co-chairs later this week. But formally, we'll engage to make sure there's no, the expectations are clear and that we can engage on this discussion. Jordan, I assume it's an old hand? Yes, it is. So that's one action item. Other one is, so we are considering organizing a meeting on the Friday before Buenos Aires, and so if there are any we are aware that there might be an ICG meeting at the same time, so we will certainly liaise with the ICG chairs about this. But I think it would be an efficient use of our resources and time to finalize our preparations so that SOAC engagement during Buenos Aires is as efficient as possible. And that's that means that, Sabina, is your question the 12th of June or 19th of June, right? Yes. So I think that would be the 19th, just the day before the Buenos Aires starts. Yes, that's confirmed. With that, Leon, do you want to very, very quickly take us through engagement? Or shall we skip the item and put it on off to the list? What do you think?
Yes, I mean we can do it to the list. I'm glad to take it to the list, and of course our last agenda item for today would be any other business. So if anyone has any other business that we can release in the next 20 seconds, we could discuss it.
And well, one aspect, and sorry, this is Mathieu speaking, the GAO request will certainly, I think, share our position on the mailing list. I think the discussion is now making things clearer, and so we can probably take this on the list as well.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mathieu. So seeing no one raising their hand for any other business, I would like to call this call adjourned, and thank you everyone for your time, and have a great day.
Thanks. Good night.
Thank you all.
Yeah. Good night.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Bye-bye.